If you think about it, human memory works almost exactly like a JPEG file on a computer.
Right, yeah. That is such a good way to put it.
Because every single time you open a mental file to remember a lost loved one, the memory actually loses a tiny bit of its original information. I mean, it compresses.
Exactly. The brain is essentially overwriting the original file with a slightly degraded, you know, smoothed over version every time you access it.
The rough edges, the gritty textures of that person or that specific moment, they just slowly fade out.
Yeah, it groups complex emotions and distinct memories into these simpler, generalized categories. And it does that just to save cognitive space.
Which makes sense from a biological standpoint, I guess.
It does, but over the years, what you are left with isn't the complex reality you actually lived alongside that person. You are left with blurry, highly idealized traits.
Which makes the act of remembering terrifying, honestly.
Yeah.
You realize you were actively, albeit accidentally, eroding the truth of someone you loved. The reality just gets compressed out of existence.
It is a terrifying thought. And that brings us to the focus of today's deep dive.
Yes, welcome to the deep dive, everyone. I am your host and joined as always by our resident art and psychology expert. Today, we are exploring how one artist decided to aggressively rebel against that inevitable cognitive memory loss.
We are looking at a really specific piece today. It's piece number 13 from a collection by the artist J.Lo Duke.
Right. The piece titled Simplemente Marley. It is this massive, imposing acrylic portrait of a white chihuahua-type dog.
And our mission today is to uncover the inner gears of that rebellion. We are going to examine exactly how Duke's technical artistic choices managed to translate raw grief into a tangible physical presence, a presence that absolutely refuses to fade.
And I think the best part of this deep dive is that we aren't just standing in a gallery guessing at the painter's intentions. We have rare access to the creator's engine room.
Yeah, the sources we have for this are incredible.
We are working directly from Duke's own technical notes, his written justifications for his color choices, and which is super rare, his incredibly raw, unvarnished self-critique of the piece.
It's essentially a set of architectural blueprints for how to build a memory that won't compress.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how he stops the memory from slipping away, we first have to look at the sheer physical reality of what he built in his studio.
Right, we have to move from the abstract concept of a fading mind to the literal heavy canvas in the room.
So paint the picture for us. Where is this happening?
So Duke is painting this in his studio in Weary, California, and he's using Liquitex acrylics. And he chooses a massive canvas. It's 36 by 36 inches.
Wow. So we're talking about almost a full square meter of physical space.
Exactly. A huge, perfectly square canvas. No, the reference for this portrait is a digital photograph taken during a daily walk in Santa Gertrude's Park in La Mirada, California.
See, here's where I have to ask the skeptical question. Duke already has a perfect digital photograph on his phone or camera. That sensor captured the exact light, the exact physiognomy of his dog Marley in that precise millisecond at that specific park. Why undergo the exhausting, titanic labor of translating that image onto a monumental canvas?
It's a fair question.
I mean, the camera sensor already preserves reality perfectly. Why spend weeks or months doing what a digital lens accomplished in, you know, 1/200th of a second?
Well, that touches on the vital distinction between documentation and connection. I mean, a digital camera is undeniably a miracle of physics.
Oh, for sure.
It purely registers physical light bouncing off objects for a fraction of a second, trapping those photons on a sensor. It acts as a historical anchor.
Meaning it proves objectively that the light looked exactly like that in Santa Gertrude's Park on that Tuesday.
Exactly. But a painting, especially one born of this kind of intense emotional labor, it doesn't arise from a need to document light. According to Duke's own notes, this painting arises from grief and from the deep, enduring connection of their souls.
I love that phrasing, the connection of their souls. So the camera captures the light of a single moment, but the painting is an attempt to capture the cumulative weight of the entire relationship.
Yes, and that cumulative weight demands scale. A massive 1 square meter canvas completely changes the physical relationship you, the viewer, have with the image.
Because it's just so big.
Right. Think about the mechanics of looking at a photo on a cell phone. It's tiny, it's backlit, and it lives in your pocket.
And you can swipe past it in a millisecond.
Exactly. You can turn the screen off and put it away when the grief feels too heavy.
It is easily dismissed. You control it.
But a 36 by 36 inch canvas on a wall, cannot be put in your pocket. It demands that your whole body stand before it. It shares your physical space, breathing the same air you do.
So Duke isn't painting a window looking backward into the past. He is constructing a continuous, undeniable space in the present.
And the sheer physical resistance of that massive object in the room is his primary weapon against the JPEG compression of his mind. You simply cannot compress a square meter of wood and dried acrylic. It forces you to confront it.
But creating a giant physical object is really only half the battle, right? If he paints her as a perfect, flawless angel like most people do when they lose a pet, he's still committing a form of memory compression.
Oh, definitely.
He's just replacing a fading truth with a comfortable lie.
And the psychology of grief heavily favors that comfortable lie. Humans have an incredibly strong instinct to apply an Instagram filter to their memories when someone dies.
We immediately want to turn them into flawless, mythological beings.
Exactly. We picture pets as angels in the clouds, you know, running endlessly in some perfect sunlit meadow, completely stripped of all their earthly flaws.
It's an understandable defense mechanism, though. The brain tries to make the sharp edges of loss easier to digest by sanding them down.
It is. But idealizing a memory until it becomes practically unrecognizable is actually a way of fleeing from the sadness.
Because you aren't remembering the real individual anymore. You are remembering a sanitized, painless avatar that never actually existed.
Right, and reading through Duke's notes, his greatest intimate challenge was actively fighting against this easy idealization. He wanted the transition from acute pain to stable serenity to be built entirely on truth.
He wanted to accept the rawness of her absence rather than pretend she was some ethereal, mythical entity waiting in the clouds.
Yeah, and doing that with a paintbrush requires immense discipline. He could have painted her however he wanted, but he used these stubborn identity anchors to ground the portrait.
Identity anchors. Like, for example, he paints her wearing her collar with this little ID tag.
Yes, that is a huge detail.
Anyone who has ever walked a small, stubborn dog like a Chihuahua knows it is not a majestic, mythical experience. It is a very gritty, mundane routine.
It really is.
Erasing that collar would instantly make her look like a free spirit of nature. It would soften the image and make it mythical.
But keeping the collar anchors her to the mundane world. It is a visual declaration that this was a specific individual. She had a name. She had a daily routine in Santa Gertrude's Park.
She had earthly constraints, and she belonged to a specific household.
Yeah.
That ID tag is a refusal to let her dissolve into a generalized concept of, you know, just a dog.
And the posture he chose does the exact same thing. She isn't caught mid-jump catching a frisbee. She isn't running dynamically across the canvas.
Right. She is in a solid resting posture.
It transmits a profound sense of security. She is grounded.
Yeah.
And literally grounding her in the composition is this intense green base painted beneath her.
Let's talk about that green base, because his notes reveal that it operates symbolically, right? It is not just a literal depiction of Californian grass.
No, not at all. That green expanse acts as a life support platform. It holds up the memory visually and conceptually, preventing the figure from floating away or resting in an empty, terrifying void.
She is supported and physically held by the paint itself.
Exactly.
Okay, so we understand the psychological goals here. Avoiding idealization, resisting memory compression, keeping her grounded. But the actual visual engineering of the piece is where Duke takes these abstract concepts and forces them into chemical pigments.
Right, the actual execution.
Yeah, like how do you paint anti-idealization?
You do it through a brilliant manipulation of color theory. Let's look at how he constructs the space of the portrait. The background is built with a deliberate transition of warm skies, oranges, pinks, and greens.
And his notes clarify, he's not trying to give the viewer a literal weather report of a La Mirada sunset.
Right. He describes the background as an effective climate. It's an atmosphere of twilight calm. But contrast that warm, sweeping background with Marley herself in the foreground.
He paints the dog in a highly contained, almost strict, monochromatic palette of grays and whites.
Yes.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because standard color theory dictates the exact opposite approach.
Exactly. In the physics of human vision and traditional painting, warm colors, like vibrant oranges and pinks, usually advance toward the viewer. They pop out and hit the retina first.
Meanwhile, cool or neutral colors, like grays and whites, tend to recede into the distance, like mountains fading on the horizon.
But Duke breaks the fundamental rule of visual physics here. He puts the receding neutral colors in the absolute front of the composition and the advancing warm colors in the back.
So by the standard rules of art, that warm background should be rushing forward and completely swallowing the quiet gray figure.
Right, it should just overtake her.
But it doesn't swallow her. It creates a visual tension that acts like a protective dome. The warm, advancing background is effectively hugging the subject.
That's a great way to describe it.
And because her colors are so neutral, it forces the viewer's brain to actively work, you know, to actively focus on the quiet grays and whites in the center just to make sense of the space.
Yeah, she doesn't need to scream in bright primary colors to assert her massive presence. The quietness of her palette, surrounded by that advancing warmth, is what makes her monumental.
He creates a massive visual gravity around her.
He does, and he enhances that gravity with his brushwork, specifically by prioritizing texture over illusion.
Right. In the warm background, his brushstrokes are loose, they're atmospheric and blurry. They're clearly paint on canvas.
But for Marley's coat, he uses highly visible, thick layers of paint that actually follow her real anatomical volume. I mean, he's carving out her ribs and muscles with the acrylic.
He's deliberately avoiding flat, photographic hyperrealism. He wants you to see the brush strokes.
Because he is actively blocking the window illusion.
The window illusion.
Yeah, when a painting is perfectly smooth and photorealistic, it creates the illusion that you are looking through a pane of glass at the real thing. It implies the subject is just on the other side, waiting for you.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
But by making the actual acrylic paint so visible and tactile, Duke proves this is an act of evocation. It is paint on a wooden frame. He creates emotional depth through the physical texture rather than trying to trick the eye with spatial depth.
He is acknowledging the reality of the loss. It's an honest evocation. Not a literal resurrection.
Exactly.
That is such a powerful distinction. A photograph tries to resurrect the moment, but the painting evokes the memory, which actually leads to the most surprising part of the source material.
Oh, the self-critique.
Yeah. We've just analyzed this incredible technical execution, the inverted color theory, the psychological grounding. The piece is brilliant and already exhibited. So why is Duke ruthlessly tearing it apart in his own notes?
The raw self-critique we reviewed is a remarkable display of intellectual rigor. Even after the piece is finished and hung on a wall, Duke is agonizing over it.
Specifically, he notes that he feels he should have risked more with the, quote, temperatures within the white of her coat. I have to push back on his behalf here. To anyone who doesn't paint for a living, stressing over the temperature of white on an already finished painting sounds like obsessive technical vanity.
It really does sound like that.
Or honestly, just having way too much free time. White is white. What is really driving this hyperfixation on a color that doesn't even have a hue?
So to understand the fixation, you have to understand the mechanics of painting light. Pure, flat white basically doesn't exist in the real world. White is highly sensitive to its environment.
Okay.
If you mix a microscopic touch of blue pigment into white paint, you get a cool white that visually recedes like a snowbank in a dark shadow.
Oh, I see.
But if you add a tiny speck of cadmium yellow, you get a warm white that advances, like that same snowbank sitting in direct sunlight. Duke felt that if he had manipulated those microscopic temperature shifts just a fraction of a degree more, he could have further sculpted her three-dimensional volume in the room.
But again, the painting is done. Why obsess over microscopic drops of blue and yellow now?
Because this reveals the true emotional engine of his entire critique, and it goes back to the core theme of our deep dive. This is not technical vanity. It is the raw, unvarnished frustration of grief.
Ah, so the desire to go back and adjust the white by a fraction of a degree is a painful, lingering urge to make Marley's presence just 1 millimeter more tangible.
Exactly. He wants to sculpt her physical volume so perfectly that she becomes real enough to touch.
That is heartbreaking.
It is. This chronic dissatisfaction, this obsessive mental tweaking of the paint, is proof that the bond between them is simply bigger than the canvas can hold. His perfectionism isn't about making a flawless piece of art. It is an ongoing act of caretaking.
As long as he is critiquing the paint, he is still actively taking care of her memory.
Yes.
That reframes the entire process. The painting ultimately is an act of gratitude, but it also actively rejects the modern pop psychology concept of closure.
Oh, definitely. We hear that word constantly.
Right. You lose someone, and society tells you to find closure. You have to shut the book, sanitize the memory, and move on.
But art hates closure. This painting keeps the door wide open. It stands as a 1 square meter physical testament that affection does not extinguish just because biology stops.
Every single brushstroke, every agonizing thought about the temperature of white paint is an act of resistance against forgetting.
The painting refuses to let her become a compressed JPEG.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this right now? Learning about Duke's exhausting technical resistance against mental compression changes how we ought to view our own visual world.
And how we curate our own histories. It challenges us to look critically at the tools we use to remember the people we love.
I want to pose a direct question to you, the listener, inspired by Duke's engine room notes. Think about an irreplaceable presence in your own life.
Someone you really don't want to lose the memory of.
Exactly. If you had to build a personal monument to them and you had to actively avoid the trap of the easy Instagram filter idealization, what small, stubborn identity anchors would you obsess over?
Would it be a scuffed pair of work boots?
Or the specific annoying way they left a coffee mug on the counter? What gritty, mundane details would you focus on to ensure that presence keeps breathing honestly in your memory without turning them into a myth?
It is a powerful exercise in truth-telling. Choosing to remember the grit and the flaws is the only way to preserve the actual person.
Which leaves me with one final thought to mull over, building on everything we've explored today.
Let's hear it.
If human memory naturally acts like a compressing JPEG file, losing data every single time we access it.
Right.
And if today we increasingly rely entirely on perfectly edited, idealized digital photos stored away in the cloud, are we actually double compressing our own history?
Oh, wow.
We're feeding our already compressing brains a steady diet of perfectly smoothed out digital lies.
That is a really unsettling thought.
Perhaps the only way to truly save a memory in the digital age isn't to back it up on a redundant hard drive. Maybe the only way to save a memory is to physically create something flawed, textured, and stubbornly mundane that demands physical space in the real world, forcing us to confront the uncompressed truth every single day.